Proconsul Aurasian, with several of his personal escort in tow, negotiated a corridor on his way to the Federation prisoner's cell. He might have interrogated them sooner, of course, but one of the cardinal rules of interrogation was to allow a prisoner time beforehand. This is Aurasian.
Your Eminence, this is Commander Hayjack. We've received a message from Romulus. I believe it is the one you were waiting for.
Aurasian thought for a moment. Relay it to the terminal in Barnock's office. I'll view it there. Aurasian out. It didn't take long for Aurasian to make his way to the office or to close the door so he could be alone. And it took even less time for him to activate the terminal. Then it was just a matter of accessing the message, which had already been downloaded from the Vengeance. Actually, the proconsul mused, it wasn't a message at all, but a packet of information. On one side of the monitor screen, there was an image of the human who had perished in the transport ship. On the other side, there was a block of data. Aurasian leaned forward to read the small-faced characters. Interesting, he thought, after just a few moments. Very interesting indeed. There was a file on the human as long as his arm, and then some. The man's name was Scott, Montgomery Scott. Born, the proconsul blinked, then leaned closer to the screen. That date was wrong, he told himself. It had to be. If this was the same Montgomery Scott, and the homeworld computers had indicated there was no other, the man would have to have been 150 years old. For a Vulcanoid, that was merely middle-aged, but for a human. Apparently, Scott had served on an earlier version of the Enterprise, under a Captain James Kirk. It seemed almost impossible that it could be the same man. He would have been too elderly to participate in such an escapade, too frail. And yet, in a way, it made sense. The Montgomery Scott in the file was an engineer of considerable acumen, and the prisoner would have to have been in command of such expertise, or he could not have set up a call for help in the form of an engine pulse, or taken charge of the transport that eventually proved his undoing. Aurasian scowled. Too bad the human had decided to take his own life, or he would have gotten to the bottom of this mystery a long time ago. In fact, wait, he thought, the color draining from his face. The Enterprise. Excitedly, Aurasian stored the Scott file and called up another, a detailed report on the Enterprise of 100 years earlier. Scrolling quickly, he found the personnel section, which described those crew members for which biographical information was available. Using his finger, he went down the list until he came to the name of the vessel's first officer. There. Slowly, a smile spread across Aurasian's face. Montgomery Scott had served alongside the reputed leader of the unificationist movement on Romulus, the Vulcan named Spock. And was it not a strange coincidence that Scott should appear in the Empire just now, when a contingent of the rebels had been captured on Constantis? A very strange coincidence. Unless the great Vulcan diplomat was one of those who had been captured, and he had been in their hands all along. The proconsul's smile broadened as he pondered the possibilities, and then instantly faded. After all, it wasn't the forces of the home world who had discovered Spock. It was Tharys. Aurasian's hands became fists. Did the governor know what a valuable prize was in his possession? Or was there still time to wrest the Vulcan from him? Deactivating the monitor, he rose from his chair. As he headed for the door, he realized he would need to obtain additional ships. His overriding concern was to obtain Spock before Tharys could make a hero of himself. And that might require some firepower. The day of the trial had come. The unificationists would be judged in an enclosed amphitheater located in the command center. As they entered, Spock noted the rows of seats that rose all around them, filled with Constantherine citizens. He placed their number at 1,000, conservatively. Directly in front of the unificationists, on a raised podium, sat Governor Tharys. As soon as the rebels were all present in the central pit, Tharys stood up behind his judicial desk and addressed his fellow citizens. We are here to carry out the justice of the Romulan Empire. And beyond, the Vulcan mused, since the cameras posted at intervals suggested the event was being broadcast over subspace channels. The governor went on. In these proceedings, we will consider those who would destroy all we have achieved as a people. We will judge them. And then we will devise their punishment in the process, reaffirming the glory and might of the Empire. The crowd roared its approval. Pausing to let the applause die down, Tharis turned a scornful eye on Surak's followers. Thousands of years ago, the seeds of the Romulan Empire were grown on the planet Vulcan among a powerful race of conquerors. However, before the mightiest on that world could unite it in a common purpose, a plague was visited on Vulcan. A philosophy of weakness overcame the population. The strong on Vulcan were faced with a choice: rule over a race of passive cowards, or strike out into the reaches of space and found an empire, before which the galaxy would one day shudder. This became our empire. The governor pointed to the unificationists. These traitors who stand before you would destroy that strength. They study the teachings of the very weaklings on whom the empire turned its back. They seek to spread that philosophy among us and reunite us with Vulcan under a tyranny of cowardice. Tharis lowered both his accusing finger and his voice, forcing the crowd to listen carefully. But this traitorous plot ends here, and it ends now. Our operatives have apprehended the traitors you see before you and collected incontrovertible proof of their guilt. Thanks to these efforts, the Empire will survive. It will endure. When the governor paused this time, a tremendous din of approval rang through the crowd, even greater than before. He nodded approvingly. We are not here to determine the guilt or innocence of those you see before you, for their guilt is certain. We are here to see justice done. Tharis turned again to the students of Surak. Do any of you traitors wish to confess your crime and pledge your allegiance to the Empire before your sentence is pronounced? Do any of you choose to denounce your treason and die citizens of the Romulan Empire? The crowd waited silently, but none of the students of Surak spoke. Spock was pleased. His followers would remain true to the movement even now, despite the reemergence of their Romulan emotions. While they could not embrace all the principles of logic and the Vulcan way of life, they had seen the waste and illogic of the Romulan Empire. If that were possible, perhaps there was yet hope for reunification. Finally, Detan, the youngest of the prisoners, stepped forward and broke the silence.
We choose the right of statement.
The right of statement was one of the oldest and most protected of Romulan privileges. A moment later, the governor answered Detan, though he did not look happy.
I grant each of you the opportunity to speak for 5 minutes, no more.
Tharis must have a good reason to end the trial today, Spock mused. Enough to risk the repercussions of abrogating the rebels' rights. Finally, the sound of the crowd ceased. In the silence that followed, Detan came forward to speak. For the 12th time, Riker peered out of the cell he shared with Data and Geordi, looking past the translucent energy barrier that confined them. The length of a short corridor away, a pair of Romulan guards walked a perpendicular passageway. As always, the Romulans were watchful but silent, offering the prisoners no clue as to their fate. Still, the human thought, he could guess what their captors had in mind. They must have been drooling over the prospect of interrogating a Starfleet officer, which made him wonder all the more about Scotty. Suddenly, Riker heard a conversation in the perpendicular corridor. More than two voices, he thought. their guards had probably run into a couple of their comrades. The problem was, he couldn't hear what they were saying. He turned to Data, whose head was already tilted in an effort to glean some information from the discussion. Fortunately, the android seemed to have recovered from the Romulan's phaser barrage. With Data's amplified sense of hearing, he had a much better chance than any mere humanoid. The android wasn't given to a wide range of facial expressions, but Riker had known him long enough to discern a happy reaction from a sad one. This one wasn't happy. A moment later, the Romulan's voices faded to nothing. Geordi frowned.
What is it, Data? Bad news?
The android nodded.
I am afraid so. They were referring to Captain Scott in the past tense. Apparently, he managed to slip out of his cell and commandeer a transport before anyone noticed he was gone. In fact, he might have gotten away entirely, except for the Warbird. However, it seems it was not the Warbird that ultimately destroyed the transport. It exploded on its own.
Geordi shook his head.
Can't be. Montgomery Scott wouldn't have done himself in. Not if he could help it.
For a while, no one spoke. Then it occurred to Riker that the three of them were still alive. If they were going to stay that way, they needed to get their minds off Scotty's death. The first officer straightened.
You know, we've been in worse situations than this. Much worse.
Geordi agreed.
Like the time Professor Moriarty took over the ship from the holodeck. And then that other time, when some of us were taken over by those aliens from the penal colony on Mabu 6. And don't forget when we were captured by Lors Borg.
Riker nodded. Something will come up. The important thing is for us to be ready for it. Abruptly, a voice came to them from somewhere in the maze of corridors outside their cell.
Well, laddie, I hope you're ready right now.
They all recognized its owner at the same time. Riker smiled. Captain Scott? As if to answer their question, Montgomery Scott came bustling into view at the end of the corridor. The man had a phaser in his hand and a sheen of sweat on his ruddy face. By the way he was grinning, one would never have guessed he was fighting for survival. One would think he was having the time of his life.
You're gonna have to stand back, lads. There's no time to figure out the security code on this energy barrier.
As Riker and his companions retreated, the older man fired at the barrier's control panel. Amid a spray of sparks, the barrier wavered and disappeared. Geordi stared at Scotty as he emerged from the cell.
I don't get it. The Romulan said you'd bought the farm.
Scott laughed softly.
Never trust a Romulan lad, especially when it comes to agriculture. And as for your other questions, I'll answer them after we get where we're going.
Good advice, Riker mused. He looked forward to finding out what Scott had in mind. All was silent in the amphitheater on Constanthus. As Spock looked on, he saw Datan exercise his right of statement. The youth spoke of his earliest years on Tavoris IV, at the time one of the newest colonies in the Empire. He was stationed there with his mother and his father, a Romulan soldier. Early on, he was taught about the Empire's victories. As he got older, the boy dreamed of serving in the Romulan military and adding to the glory of the Empire. But in time, he came to see there was something wrong with the planet where he lived. According to Datan, Tavoris' inhabitants served the Empire as slaves, on farms or in mines. For years, Datan had believed the government propaganda that said the Empire brought prosperity to the worlds it touched. But if this wasn't true on Tavoris, he began to wonder if it was true anywhere.
Shortly thereafter, the Tavorans rebelled. And though the rebels were defeated quickly, my father was killed in the fighting. My mother and I returned to Romulus to live with her family, barely surviving on my father's small military pension. Unfortunately, his service to the Empire had been forgotten. On Romulus, I learned about the unification movement and heard the stories of Sorak. I discovered a way to live where everyone was free. I learned about a rational way of thinking and living where people made decisions based on the principles of logic. On Vulcan, I would not have been sentenced to death for trying to learn something new.
Spock saw a hush fall over the crowd. It considered the youth for a long moment.
and then the spectators began to speak amongst themselves, sounding strangely disaffected. Tharis called for quiet. He signaled for the guards to bring the next prisoner forward. Each one in turn told his or her story. And when they finished, each one was accorded a respectful silence. In the end, even Spock was moved by their testaments. And only then did he understand why the Romulans could not accept their deaths as he did. What was happening to the students of Surak was wrong. It was both that simple and that complex. Though a lifetime of training prevented his emotions from revealing themselves, the Vulcan felt this as strongly as he had felt anything in his life. Then it was his turn to speak. Coming forward, he looked up at the row upon row of Constantharine citizenry and mulled over what wisdom he might impart to them. My friends, I ask you to look at us. We, the students of Surak, have done nothing worse than embrace a rational way of life. For this, we are considered enemies of the state. Because knowledge, any knowledge, is a danger to the Empire. And the most dangerous sort of knowledge is that which diverges from state policy. However, I ask you, is there anyone here today who has not had a thought in conflict with official laws, proclamations, or histories? Yet you are loyal citizens? Should having such a thought brand you a traitor? Indeed, what can be said for a government whose laws make its people traitors? Understand, I do not wish to alarm you. After all, you need not fear this government for long. The day is coming soon when the Empire will collapse of its own weight. When it will... Tharis was on his feet suddenly, his voice a surf that seemed to break everywhere at once.
Enough!
The governor's eyes narrowed with fury. He pointed to the assembled citizens.
You have heard the words of treason from the traitor's own mouths. They do not dispute the charges. They admit they are guilty of the worst crime a Romulan can commit. The destruction of our society from within.
Tharis gave the spectators a moment to consider his words. Then he turned again to the students of Surak.
After appropriate deliberation, this tribunal finds you guilty of the crimes of which you've been accused. The penalty is execution.
Pausing dramatically, the governor waited for a response from the crowd, the cheer of approval that had greeted him earlier. But this time, he was answered with silence. And in that silence, Spock believed he saw the eventual end of the Romulan Empire.
Scotty poked his head around a corner, aimed, and fired. His phaser beam slammed into yet another Romulan, sending the man sprawling. He took just a moment to make certain the guard was unconscious like the other two. Then, satisfied, he gestured for his three companions to follow him. As they threaded their way among the unconscious Romulans, the Enterprise officers all stooped to pick up the guard's weapons. Not that it would be necessary if all went according to plan. At the end of the corridor, Scott saw the light at the end of the tunnel. Except in this case, the light was actually a door. A sign just over it laid out clearly in Romulan characters designated the room beyond as a transporter chamber. Scott was gladder than ever he'd taken the time to learn foreign languages, Romulan among them. Heading for the panel beside the door, he pressed his palm against it. A moment later, they were inside. He pointed to the transporter platform.
Up there with you, lads.
As Riker ascended to the platform, he posed a question.
So how did you escape?
Scott was already fiddling with the transporter controls.
I guess the Romulans never held a Starfleet engineer in one of their cells. It was nay that difficult to pry off a bulkhead plate and disable the energy barrier. When the Romulans saw a transport vessel take off, then fail to answer their hails, they thought it was me. And when it exploded, they thought I was dead. But I was never on the ship in the first place.
Geordi smiled knowingly.
Remote control.
Scotty nodded.
I sent the transport out as a decoy, so I could lie low until the warbird was gone. Unfortunately, when the three of you were captured, that was no longer an option.
Tapping one last pad, he came around the control bank and hopped up on the platform beside the others.
Next stop, the Yorktown.
That's when a squad of Romulans came running in, weapons drawn. But before they could fire, Scott found himself on the bridge of the Yorktown, his friends standing on either side of him.
Welcome to the USS Yorktown. Enjoy your starship adventure. And please, take all wrappers and other refuse with you when you leave.
The others looked at him. Scott shrugged.
I kinda seem to turn the damn thing off.
As Scott took the center seat, he saw the first officer take the helm while Data sat down beside him at navigation. As if by instinct, Geordi made a beeline for the engineering station. Scott turned to him.
Activate the cloak, lad.
The engineer looked at him. Scotty smiled.
How do you think I got this far?
Shaking his head, Geordi worked the necessary controls. Next, Scotty fixed his attention on the android.
Chart us a course for Constanthus, Mr. Data. And get us there as quick as you can. With this cloak of ours, there's no need for us to sneak about.
But before Data could act on the order, Riker turned around in his chair.
We didn't come out here to rescue Spock, sir. We came here to rescue you, and we've done that.
Scotty eyed him.
What are you saying? That you'd abandon one of the greatest men who ever lived?
Riker shook his head.
Of course not. But we've already made our share of blunders in trying to get you out. Because we didn't know there was a plan already in motion, I'd hate to do something that would complicate any effort by Captain Picard.
But your captain doesn't know how things have changed. You see, I tapped into the Romulans' computer system before I came to get you out. And it seems Proconsul Arasian has found out about Spock. Now that he realizes what kind of fish he's hooked, he'll waste no time frying him.
The others looked pained by the news. Riker came to a decision.
All right. We'll head for Constanthus and do what we can to get Spock out of there. But first, we'll send a message to Captain Picard, alerting him to our intentions.
Aye. Contact your captain, then. But for God's sakes, make it quick. Our friend Spock could be roasted on a spit while we dawdle.
McCoy opened his eyes with a start. It took him a moment or two to realize Worf was talking to him.
What is it, Lieutenant?
The Klingon frowned.
I merely alerted you to an incoming message, sir. It's Governor Tharis.
Then what are you waiting for, Mr. Worf? Give me a blasted visual and step back. I'll show you how a professional reels in a fish.
As McCoy got to his feet, the image of the Governor leapt to the screen.
Governor Tharis, time's a-wasting, sir. If we're going to work together, we'd better get our show on the road.
The governor smiled a thin-lipped smile.
I would have responded sooner, Admiral. However, it was necessary for me to consider certain ramifications of your proposal.
And now that you've had some time to think about it, is there any other course of action that makes sense?
Tharis shrugged.
Actually, there is. Particularly the one wherein I maintain possession of the Vulcan.
McCoy's jaw dropped.
I see you remember your old friend, Spock. Once I took the time to think about it, I knew there had to be a reason they would send someone like you out here. The same reason you were pressing so hard for the return of the Rebels. Because according to my intelligence, you served with Spock on the Enterprise. Because you were his comrade. And because he is one of the prisoners who languish in my jail.
That doesn't change anything, Governor. The proposition on the table is still a good one.
It is? Which do you think would enhance my career more? To spare the homeworld a minor embarrassment, or to show the Empire that I have captured the great Spock?
The governor's image vanished from the screen. McCoy tried to contemplate the magnitude of what he'd done. Glancing about, he saw that everyone was looking at him, pitying him for his failure. What's more, he couldn't help but agree with them, without meaning to. He just signed his friend's death sentence. Picard was going over the ship's log yet again when he was interrupted by an intercom summons.
Lieutenant Worf,
Calling Captain Picard. Please respond.
This is the captain. What is it, Mr. Worf?
The Klingon told him about McCoy's conversation with Governor Tharis and the way the Admiral had abdicated command.
As soon as he realized what he'd done, Captain, he turned pale, and then he left the bridge.
I get the picture, Mr. Worf. Picard out.
The captain tapped his communications badge.
Computer, locate Admiral Leonard McCoy.
Admiral McCoy is in the 10 forward lounge.
Picard nodded. It seemed the Admiral's psyche was in good hands. Rising, he pulled down on the front of his tunic. He had a long, difficult road ahead of him. But it felt good to be the captain again. Tharis still had one loose end to tie up. He didn't expect it would be very difficult, not when the key to everything he needed was well within his grasp. Flanked by two of his personal guards, he approached the entrance of the rebels' cells. The sentinels posted there saluted him crisply in the Romulan manner. As well they should, the governor mused. After all, he would be rising swiftly in the political hierarchy after it became known he'd apprehended Spock. And if they served him well, his people would be rising with him. Without hesitation, Tharis entered the cell warren. The prisoners emerged from their rooms and eyed him warily, but they didn't move against him. Tharis smiled.
It has come to my attention that the legendary Spock is among you. Unfortunately, while I know that one of you is the esteemed Vulcan, I do not know which one. Therefore, I will need some assistance to identify him.
With that, he turned to Skrasis. Looking neither right nor left at the stares he was drawing, the infiltrator stepped forward. The governor was reluctant to waste any more time here.
Skrasis, which of these bedraggled specimens is the real Spock?
A murmur went through the ranks of the Unificationists. No doubt they were surprised to find out the identity of Tharis's agent. Skrasis gazed at the assembled prisoners, looking from one to the next. Finally, he turned to Tharis, his jaw muscles fluttering as if he were struggling with something.
I cannot say, Governor. It would be a betrayal of one I have come to admire.
At first, Tharis thought he had heard his agent incorrectly. Then he realized that Skrasis had become one of them. And by virtue of that, he was now useless. He came face to face with the spy.
You're making a mistake, Skrasis. A very big mistake. Perhaps, Governor. But it is the path I have chosen.
For a moment, Tharis wanted to kill, to pay Skrasis back for his arrogance. Then the moment subsided. Turning to the rebels themselves, the governor realized there was still an option open to him. He took it.
My agent's stupidity is your opportunity. I need to identify the one called Spock. And to do that, I require your help. My request, and for now it is only a request, does not come without its rewards for those who comply with it.
There was a shuffling of feet. A predictable reaction, Tharis told himself. No one wanted to think of himself as a traitor, though he was certain someone would shoulder that burden if the price was right. He amended his offer.
Rather than restrict my gratitude to only those who offer assistance, I will reward everyone. And why not? Am I not the governor of this planet? Do I not hold the power of life and death?
Tharis scanned the assemblage for some clue that would tell him what he wanted to know. As yet, there was nothing. He got right to the point.
I am offering amnesty for everyone present, except Spock himself, of course, and for him, I extend protection from the homeworld authorities.
Still nothing. The governor's teeth grated.
You understand, I will find Spock in any case. By cooperating, you will only make things easier on yourselves and on him. It is the only logical option open to you.
But the rebels did not respond. Tharis could feel the blood rushing to his face.
I had hoped to be merciful, but you've made that impossible.
He glanced at Skrasis.
Stand with these rebels, traitor, but rest assured, you will share their fate when the time comes.
Then turning his back on the Unificationists, the governor marched out of the cell and down the corridor. He shook his head. What power did the Vulcan have that enabled him to bind people to his cause? Even people like Scrasus, who had started out squarely opposed to it. No matter. When they faced the moment of their execution, they would crack. When Tharys was gone, Spock looked to Scrasus. So did the other unificationists, though with hatred in their eyes. The infiltrator, on the other hand, retained control. Inwardly, the Vulcan commended him for it. Scrasus appealed to him. "May I have a word with you, teacher? In private?" Spock shrugged, then turned and walked in the direction of his quarters. Several of his students trailed them, fearing that Scrasus would inflict some harm on their mentor. But the Vulcan waved them away. "It is all right. Scrasus has no intention of harming me." Reluctantly, the students returned to their cells. Sitting, Spock invited Scrasus to do the same. The Romulan sat.
I wish to explain, teacher."
"No explanation is necessary. I have known of your affiliation with our captors for some time." Scrasus' brow creased.
"I do not understand. You allowed me to continue as your student?"
"You were my student. You wished to learn what I wished to teach. And there is another logical reason that you perhaps do not see. You were the only one of my students I knew would survive." The infiltrator was stunned by this simple statement. The Vulcan could see the pain on his face, his control broken at last.
"And now, teacher, even I will not survive. Still, I wish to thank you for your instruction and to tell you I took no pleasure in my task. I simply did my duty."
Spock nodded. "As do we all, student of Sorak. Live long and prosper." Scrasus returned the splay-fingered gesture. "Peace and long life, teacher." Unfortunately, the Vulcan mused, they would know neither. Guinan wasn't surprised when she saw the Admiral deposit himself at her bar. McCoy was mumbling something as she walked over. She could make out one word.
"Kajarju, Admiral."
McCoy looked up.
"Kajarju means idiot in Tautanese. You see, I just decided I was 12 kinds of an idiot and I was trying to name them all." "That's a lot of self-deprecation for a man in your position."
"In my position, you would think I'd know better. You would think I'd have a little perspective."
Guinan took out an old dusty bottle full of green liquid and a clean glass and poured the Admiral 2 fingers worth. McCoy downed the contents, then made a sound of satisfaction.
"It's nice to know some things get better with age, even if I'm not one of them."
"I don't know, Admiral. You don't look so old to me."
"I'm 145, young lady."
Guinan placed her elbows on the bar and leaned forward.
"At 145, I was just getting started."
McCoy stared at her.
"How old are you?"
"Old enough to know you're no Kajarju.
Now, you were saying something about perspective."
McCoy's eyes fixed on his empty glass.
"Back in the old Enterprise, I really hated those Federation ambassadors from hell. The kind who think they know more than the captain and end up demonstrating they know nothing at all. Now I've become the very thing I hated. Just like all those other stuffed shirts, I've managed to make a mess of things. It's a good thing Jim's not around to see this."
Guinan did her best to look sympathetic. "You had a great deal of respect for your captain. A great deal of affection." McCoy nodded.
"You're damn right I did. He was the finest commanding officer who ever lived."
"I didn't know your captain, but I know mine. And if you had asked me, I would have said the same thing about him. The finest who ever lived, I mean."
The Admiral scowled. "Jim never would have sat there waiting for the enemy to make the first move. He would have taken the bull by the horns."
"I've seen Captain Picard take the bull by the horns, too. But most of the time, he finds another way."
"So what you're saying is I should have had a little more confidence in your captain and his method of dealing with the Romulans as well?"
"Yes, sir. Different era, different Romulans. You've got to change with the times."
So this captain of yours, he's got it all figured out, has he?
Not exactly. There were a couple of things he didn't quite understand even before you made the situation a bit more complicated. For instance, the way the Romulans are moving so many ships toward the border with the Stug. There doesn't seem to be any... The Admiral interrupted her.
The Stug, you say? And the Romulans are deploying their ships to that sector?
That's what Lieutenant Worf told me just a little while ago. McCoy looked surprised.
Damn, so that's what he was trying to talk to me about. Wait a minute. The Stug could never get together on anything, much less a military offensive. Why would the Romulans be so concerned with them?
That's what Captain Picard was wondering. McCoy pushed himself back from the bar.
I appreciate the hospitality, Guinan. All of it.
That's what I'm here for, Admiral. With a gentlemanly nod, he headed for the exit. Guinan could tell he was still pondering something she said. Guinan smiled. When they left 10 forward with that look on their faces, she knew she'd done her job. Picard looked around the observation lounge table. Only Worf, Beverly, and Deanna looked back at him. Abruptly, the door to the room slid aside. It revealed Admiral McCoy, who seemed more frail than ever. He quietly took the chair usually reserved for Commander Riker on Picard's right. The captain cleared his throat.
We have received a subspace message from Commander Riker. Apparently, he and his companions are all right, and they've found Captain Scott in good shape as well.
The Admiral smiled.
That's wonderful, dammit.
Dr. Crusher looked relieved as well.
Then Will was just reporting that they're on their way back?
The captain shook his head.
On the contrary. They are taking the Yorktown deeper into Romulan territory. It seems Governor Tharis is not the only one aware of Spock's presence on Constanthus. Apparently, Proconsul Aragian has learned of it as well.
Troy sighed.
Then that's why Will and the others have agreed to head for Constanthus? They're going to try to free Ambassador Spock.
Picard nodded.
However, they don't know that Tharis knows about Spock, which means he'll be guarding the Ambassador a lot more closely now. Our colleagues are reaching into a bigger hornet's nest than they're prepared for.
Crusher looked at him, her concern etched into her face.
So what do we do?
McCoy spoke up.
I'll tell you what we don't do. We don't go traipsing after them. That's the kind of shoot-from-the-hip behavior that got us into trouble before.
Picard turned to him.
Then you think we should rely on their resourcefulness, Admiral? Count on their succeeding without our help?
The Admiral's lips pressed together.
I don't like the idea, but if we go charging in after them, we'll be risking even more lives. As for Spock, he'll find some way to avoid being used as a pawn, even if it means his death.
Picard turned to the others.
Admiral McCoy makes a valid point. As it stands now, there are only 4 lives at stake, 5 if we include Spock's. Risking 1,000 lives to save a handful is not only bad arithmetic, it's bad command philosophy.
He could see the disappointment in his officer's eyes.
However, with Spock's identity exposed, negotiation is no longer an option. Nor is Spock the only one capable of being used as a pawn by the Romulans. There are now also 3 Starfleet officers, 4 if you include Captain Scott, and that aspect of the situation is not to be taken lightly. What's more, long-range sensors indicate that patrols are remarkably light in Constanthus's sector, as they seem to be in many portions of the Empire these days. And unlike Commander Riker, we know what to expect vis-a-vis the acceleration of events there. Hence, we have an excellent chance of getting through.
McCoy slumped back into his chair. His expression was one of outright disbelief.
You're going after them?
I am indeed, Admiral. There is a time for patience and a time for action. This is a time for action.
He turned to Worf, then Troy.
Make sure the battle bridge is in working order, Lieutenant. Counselor, prepare the crew for saucer separation. We'll be taking leave of our civilian population in 20 minutes.
Next, Picard looked to Dr. Crusher.
You'll be in command of the saucer, Beverly. I want you to wait here until we get back. Unless, of course, the saucer is endangered, then you are to leave.
The doctor frowned at the prospect, but she knew her duty. If anyone could make the tough decisions, she could.
A moment later, they were all gone, leaving Picard alone with the Admiral. McCoy shook his head.
Well, Captain, I guess you've got something in common with that friend of mine after all, just when you think you know someone.
Picard allowed himself a smile.
Tell me, Admiral, will you be staying on the saucer section?
McCoy smiled back.
Not on your life, Captain. Spock would never let me hear the end of it.
As Tharis emerged from his office, he surveyed the courtyard and the high stone wall that ringed it. As at the trial, he had set up cameras at intervals, cameras which would broadcast over subspace channels to points as far away as Romulus. After all, what was the point of a spectacle if there was no one there to see it, or to learn from it the determination and efficiency of the formidable Governor Tharis? Such were his thoughts as he approached the gallows he'd constructed. Of course, he would only use them to the extent he had to. His real plan was to terrify Spock and the other prisoners slowly and thoroughly until one of them lost his composure and gave up the Vulcan. What's more, he was absolutely certain it would work. Otherwise, he wouldn't have allowed the entire Empire to bear witness. Turning toward the prisoners' cells, he gestured, and a group was forced out into the courtyard, each of its members walking with hands manacled. As the Unificationists approached the gallows, they sized up the instrument of their doom. No doubt they were wondering what it would be like to feel the noose tightened around their necks, to hear the order given, and to have the trap door swing away, leaving them to twitch and die at the ends of their ropes. Tharis smiled to himself. Their mouths would be turning drier than dust right about now. Their stomachs would be clenching with fear. Truly, it was only a matter of time. The governor's executioners ascended to the platform. Each one took up a position behind a trapdoor and stood with his arms folded across his chest, a series of imposing figures against the blue-green sky. But at least for the moment, none of the Unificationists yielded Spock's identity. Without expression, without complaint, the rebels marched up to the foot of the gallows and awaited further instructions. The governor shook his head in mock sadness. He pointed to the woman closest to him and turned to Faberus. Place this one on the platform. Yes, governor. Before Tharis was done, he had picked out six of the rebels. Four females, two young men. Scrasis he would save for the next batch. That is, if he needed a next batch. Slowly, the executioners guided their nooses over the prisoners' heads and tightened them. The rebels simply stared off into the distance. At a word from Tharis, a half-dozen levers would be pulled, releasing the same number of trapdoors. The governor raised his hand, but none of the prisoners relented. He sighed and let his hand drop.
No!
The executioners hesitated, gazing at something behind Tharis. The governor whirled and saw that a half-dozen Romulans had beamed down into the courtyard. What's more, Tharis recognized one of them, the one whose voice still echoed in the courtyard. It was no less a dignitary than Proconsul Erasian. Was he mad? The governor wondered. What was the Proconsul doing all the way out here, so far from the seat of his power? Certainly he hadn't come all this way just to lord it over a few captured rebels. Unless, of course, he knew the prize in their midst. The governor cursed under his breath. That was it, wasn't it? Erasian knew about Spock. The proconsul came forward, followed by his guards. Greetings, Governor Tharis. Have I caught you at a bad time? With a gesture, Tharis signaled to his men to turn off the cameras. Then he glared at Erasian. Let us not play games, proconsul. What are you doing here? Is this not part of the Empire, Governor? Am I not proconsul? I go where I please. And right now, it pleases me to be here, so I can take these traitors into custody. Tharis shook his head. They are already in custody. Mine. A jurisdictional technicality, Governor. I'll see to it that it's taken care of after I return to Romulus. It's more than a technicality, proconsul.
I am the authority on this world. I have a right to these prisoners.
Aurasian's smile faded away. It must have become clear to him then that Tharis knew what kind of prize he held and that he was not eager to let it go. The governor frowned. He could yield to the proconsul's authority and avoid any further confrontation, or he could refuse and leave himself open to punishment and death. Everything hinged on his identifying Spock and turning him over to the Senate. If he could do that, Aurasian would be powerless to carry out his retribution. But if he failed, Tharis set his teeth. He would never have a chance like this one again. He turned to Faberus.
Take Proconsul Aurasian and his escort into protective custody. I'd hate to see them get hurt as we carry out the executions.